Call to order the second meeting of the Capital Investment Committee. We are very close to a quorum, but we'll start out anyway. Then we'll approve those minutes when we have a quorum. So we'll skip that part of the agenda, and we are going to move on to the presentation of the Governor's 2005 Capital Budget Recommendations. And joining us at the table is our good friend, Mr. Lee Merkins from the Department of Finance.
Thank you.
Mr. Merkins, it is always our pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, I am Lee Merkins from the Department of Finance. On behalf of the Governor and the Governor's staff, thank you for the opportunity to present the Governor's recommendations to your committee today. Commissioner Ingeson normally would accompany me in these types of presentations, but with the release of the Governor's biennial budget yesterday, she is accompanying the Governor today in a series of meetings describing the biennial budget recommendations. So it's just little old me today, and I'll try to get through the information. I'll be working off from a couple different pieces of paper today. You see the agenda before you. I also have prepared a spreadsheet that shows a comparison of Governor's 2004-2005 Governor's recommendations. You can look at that. I also provided a side-by-side on the green sheet that shows Governor House File 3 and Senate File 1, just as a FYI for you. My intent today, Mr. Chairman, is not to go through each and every one of the Governor's 100 project recommendations. Most of those projects came before your committee last year. If new members have questions on individual projects, I'd be more than happy to answer questions. But my goal is to do really two things. One, to explain how the Governor's recommendations have changed from 2004 to 2005. And then second of all, to just kind of talk about where there might be differences between the Governor and the House, and take the opportunity to just sort of talk about where some of those projects might have fallen through the cracks, so to speak.
Sure. Thank you. Before you do that, Speaker, one housekeeping item. Representative Knobloch, I'm sure, would move the minutes of the Tuesday, January 11th meeting, the first meeting.
So moved.
Thank you. All those in favor of the approval of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? The minutes are approved. I'm sorry for that. Please continue. Do you want to walk us through maybe the new items first, and you know, jump in with questions as you have them, members.
All right, very good. Members, I'll be working off from the stapled agenda materials, and particularly the page called Governor's 2005 Capital Budget Recommendations. I'll go through each of these items, and if members have questions, feel free to stop me, and I'll provide more depth. I'm going to try to go at a summary level and see if I can get through the whole package today. First of all, the changes from the Governor's 2004 capital budget recommendations in 2005, he expanded the size of his bill. In 2004, he had a total bonding bill the size of $754 million. That has been increased to $816 million. And if you're looking at the GO bonding portion only, it's gone up from $688 to $744. One of the things that happened in that, you know, in that 1 year interim where the bonding bill wasn't adopted in 2004 and going into the 2005 session, I think the Governor heard from interested constituents, agencies, higher education institutions, legislators, and decided to make some minor modifications and add some additional projects that were not added last year. So those would be the ones that I'll go through in a moment. The size of the bonding bill, just to put it in perspective, if the Governor's bonding bill were adopted as recommended, it would be the third largest bonding bill in the history of the state of Minnesota, following the billion-dollar bonding bill in 1998 and an $834 million bonding bill in the year 2000. The first thing that's changed is inflation, and I'll spend a minute talking about construction inflation, and stop me if I get too detailed, but here goes. In the capital project world, in the construction world, time is obviously money. When project requests come to you as members of this committee, you're obviously aware of the total project cost that is presented, but on the capital budget forms, there are a discrete number of line items that break out total project costs. Land acquisition costs, pre-design, design, construction, furniture, fixtures of equipment. There's a line item for project contingencies, and there's also a line item for construction inflation. So when the 2004 request came before this committee last year, each and every project already had a certain amount of project inflation already added in. And that inflation amount varies on a project-by-project basis. It reflects the duration of the project from the time it starts to the time it ends. Not all projects have the same project schedule. Some take longer, some are shorter. A shorter project, the project that takes a less amount of time, might be a simple asset preservation project, a new roof, a new boiler, something like that. Might take 6 months. If you're looking at a major capital project where you have to acquire a site, go through the design process, build it, it could be a couple of years from start to finish. Those projects that have longer time frames that get pushed out farther into the future have a greater risk for exposure to inflation and are inflated at a higher level. So when the project request came to you last year, each and every project had a certain inflation estimate in. Normally, we estimate construction inflation somewhere in the 3-4% annual rate. And most years, that would be satisfactory. The problem is that in this last year, we saw construction inflation at an unprecedented high level, an annual rate higher than what we've seen since the 1970s. Usually, construction inflation has a labor component and it has a building materials component. Labor may be 40% of the inflation and the material 60%. This last year, however, was really driven significantly by the cost of raw materials. Steel has gone up, concrete has gone up, and all these have resulted in a really significant spike up in the cost of raw materials, and that's increasing the construction inflation number. Long story made short, the Department of Finance was estimating that we would have construction inflation in the 3-4% normal rate. The rate actually is in the double digits. You really need to add about another, we think, another 8.63% on top of the 3% inflation that was already factored into these various projects. How we get to that number, we in the Department of Finance are not architects, engineers, construction managers. We're primarily accountants and budget officers. We don't pretend to understand the construction industry as well as others. We retain the services of a national cost planning, construction cost planning firm, CPMI. They have a regional office in Bloomington. They are, that's who they are and that's what they do. They estimate construction inflation. They work with not just national construction indexes, but also work with Minnesota builders, contractors, labor unions, suppliers of raw materials, to understand what's going out there and going on out there in the real world in regards to construction inflation. And what we found both in Minnesota as well as nationwide, that as the national economy picks up and as there's more demand for building, and particularly as the international marketplace picks up, especially in places like China, which has significant demand for construction and raw materials, it's increasing the price of those raw materials and the construction supplies. Also, oil prices going up didn't help matters at all. Oil used as part of the construction process for the raw materials as well as transportation added to the cost. All these have added price pressures on the construction inflation side. And for that reason, the Department of Finance, in conjunction with our consultants, have recommended to the governor, and the governor now recommends to you that the individual building projects in his recommendations be inflated an additional 8.63%. And his recommendations for building projects do contain that additional amount of inflation. As a side note, that doesn't include each and every project. We're talking about building projects. The governor is not recommending inflating asset preservation lump sum requests. He is not talking about inflating lump sum grant requests. It's just talking about inflating the building projects themselves. We recognize that costs are going up on the asset preservation side. It's just a thought that when we're putting $20, $30, $40 million out there as a lump sum for asset preservation requests, those costs are going up, but the thought is the agencies that get those appropriations have some flexibility to manage within those lump sum requests. Less sub-projects to be done, but anyway, that's the governor's recommendation so far.
Mr. Merkin, what about things like the road and bridge? I mean, the you know, those costs are going up as well for the counties or towns or whoever. Why not include inflation on those projects? A little bit different than the HEAPER or whatever.
Mr. Chairman, members, it wouldn't be intellectually incorrect to do that. Costs are going up in the road construction projects just like they're going up in building projects. It's just the thought of the governor that, again, if you have a large lump sum request, whether it's for grants or whether it's for asset preservation or whether it's for road and bridge construction, that the agencies that get those appropriations have some flexibility of managing within the appropriation amount. But it does mean that if you do not inflate them, it means that you have less projects to do within the dollar amount.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so I'm clear, you were earlier talking about a built-in 3% inflation.
Right.
And then you added on to these numbers 8.63, so we're at 11.63 inflation above and beyond.
Mr. Chairman, members, as an average, that is correct. We're using an average for these various projects, yes.
Thank you.
Great. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Merkins, the reference you make of the 3% and 8.6 is an annualized current rate of inflation?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes.
And then why, if are you assuming we're not going to pass a bonding bill until the 1st of July? I mean, if we're going to pass a bonding bill potentially within 9 months of last year, why are we not using three-fourths of those numbers instead of the full 100%?
Mr. Chairman, members, it's a fair question. What we did to calculate the 8.63% is we looked at what we thought the difference would be May 2004 to May 2005. So when we advertised that 8.63% number, we looked at what inflation has occurred so far this year and what we think will occur through the remaining couple of months. If, for example, there was an early bonding bill earlier than May 2005, a case could be made to inflate it by less than 8.63%. We have a formula that has a different inflation number for each month of the year going forward. So, you know, the farther out you push it, the more the inflation theoretically should be added. If you did an early bonding bill, it would go the other way, and it might not need the full inflation amount.
Great. Mr. Merkins, I'll ask the rookie question here. What happens, you know, you've got a dollar amount there, that's how much you appropriate for it. They fall short or don't use it. Either fall short, project actually costs more, or costs less. How does that work out?
Mr. Chairman, members, I suppose it depends upon the nature of the project, and I could see different scenarios of what might happen. You know, estimating construction cost is as much an art as it is a science, and I think even our experts, and by the way, I do have the folks from CPMI here today, and if you want to hear directly from the cost estimators, I can bring them up. But estimating these costs is a matter of trying to minimize risk by trying to understand what the cost of the project is in the marketplace. Well, okay, so let's say you don't inflate them up to the full amount, or let's say the marketplace, there's something going on in the marketplace that you can't anticipate generally. I suppose the first thing is that if you don't have inflation and you can hope that just out of good luck your projects come in below budget, that you get a low bid that might save you. And that would be your first line of defense. Unfortunately, you know, betting on a low bid and gambling on it is probably not the first thing that you'd want to do. And sometimes going with a low bid is not necessarily the best bid. Another line of defense is most projects have some amount of project contingencies built into the cost estimates. That project contingency can vary based upon project and the complexity and size of the project. If for some reason your bids come in high, you can go to your project contingency amount and hope that you have enough project contingencies to cover the difference. The downside of that is then you better hope that somewhere along the lines through the course of the project no surprises come up that would otherwise cost you additional money. And finally, if your project is underfunded, you can reduce the size and scope of the project. Generally, you know, we hope that when the legislature makes an appropriation for a project, the legislature gets what they think they paid for. And we also hope that we avoid the situation where agencies or institutions would ever have to come back for a supplemental appropriation for their capital project.
What if we overfund it?
Well, it
they build bigger.
Ever seen anybody send us money back, apparently?
Not very much.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, every once in a while it does happen. As you may recall, when Mr. Sossin was here for one of your previous meetings, he talked about the cancellation report where balances were still available 4 years after the project appropriation was awarded. In some cases, those are remaining balances that were not needed for a project. So theoretically, if you overfunded, those balances could be there, and theoretically they could cancel when the four-year period rolls around. I think there's also a chance that the agencies or institutions that got the appropriation could probably find additional ways to spend the money somewhere along the line as well.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Merkins, you stated that about 40% of the cost is labor and 60% generally on major projects is material. Is that correct?
Mr. Merkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, that was normally the case when we were estimating inflation in that 3-4% rate. This time around, maybe to anticipate your next question, the 8.63% is overwhelmingly raw materials, not labor.
So, Mr. Chairman, my question is, if you have a $10 million project and you get some inflation built into that, we don't want to necessarily put the 8.3% on the $10 million, but on a portion of that, right? Because the labor costs have not skyrocketed.
Mr. Merkins?
Mr. Chairman, members, no. Actually, you would inflate the whole project amount by the 8.63%, which would incorporate both the raw materials costs and the labor costs.
So, but labor hasn't gone up that extent. So what is the actual inflation factor for raw material?
Mr. Merkin.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll take the first shot at it, and I'll look over to our consultant in the audience. I think, if I remember correctly, the original 4% that we normally would have gone with would have assumed, you know, let's say 2% labor inflation rate. The 8.63% I thought I heard was maybe an additional 2-3% labor rate. I'll call Mr. Goodwin to the table, and I'll let him perhaps answer that, Mr. Chair. This is Peter Goodwin from CPMI.
Great. Mr. Goodwin, welcome to the committee. If you'd please state your name for the record, we'd be appreciative and look to be enlightened in the area of inflation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I am Peter Goodwin, Vice President, Chief Estimator of CPMI.
Welcome. If you've heard the questions, but essentially, Representative Solberg is asking the 8.63, should it really be 8.63 since labor hasn't went up or is materials higher? How'd you arrive at it? Have I paraphrased
it? We're basing it on labor costs in Minnesota have gone up in the 4-5% range over the past 3 years, and they have 3-year contracts, so they go in a cycle. So of the 8.63%, labor can be 40-50%. It really depends on the type of project, and material is the balance of that. We've seen material increases in Minnesota this last year up to 12%. Some of the materials, steel has gone up 40%, lumber's gone up sometimes 80%. So this is all factored in. What we do is we look at different indices which track major materials and labor contracts. We use Engineering News Record, we use American Appraisal, BEC indexes, and we use RS Means, which is, I have to look here, is a Reed Publishing. We talk to contractors, we talk to vendors, suppliers. So we come up with a combination of a lot of factors that make up these indices.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my question then, or my concern is that particularly on the major projects, like in Minsku and University of Minnesota, has the administration taken each of those projects and establish an inflation factor that is more than just applying a percentage to it, but actually looking at the individual project and seeing how much steel is being used and so forth.
It isn't just steel.
Well, I understand it's not just that, but what I'm saying is, you know, if there's a variance of labor and material, and there's variance within the material range, I have the MINSCU and University of Minnesota, they, on an individual project basis, done more than just apply a percentage to that project.
Mr. Goodwin, perhaps in your answer, you also, for the new members of the committee, CPMI, tell us what you do.
CPMI is a construction management firm, principal business. We do independent estimating for architects and engineers and agencies throughout the Midwest. We've been in business since the early 70s. We've done a lot of the state buildings, construction management, project management for estimating. We're currently the owner's representative on the state Ag Health office building and lab.
And so for either one of you, then Representative Silver's question is, did you look at the projects individually? Did Minsky look at them individually? University of Minnesota looked at Kolthoff Hall. Did they go in and actually take a peek at that whole thing, or who did? Or
I'll take the first stab at that. Mr. Chairman, members, what the Department of Finance recommended to the governor was to go with an overall average that would even out the pluses and the minuses for individual projects. It would not be an incorrect methodology to look at each and every project, and you could, if you wanted to, try to do an evaluation of each and every project and come to a conclusion about how much concrete, how much steel, how much lumber, how much labor, where they're located geographically, the challenges that might be associated with projects that are either in the metro area or far from it. In the interest of time and just frankly trying to save our sanity, and do an early bonding bill, the governor made a strategic decision to just go with an average and to not reopen up every single project for negotiation on an inflation amount, because we thought that that would be a recipe for then having to argue and negotiate every single inflation estimate for every single project. We didn't think that would be the best approach to take, and we saw a real downside to that. So what the Department of Finance recommended to the governor and what the governor went with is just the average for an average project. Again, that might mean that some projects might need a little bit more. It might mean that some projects might need a little bit less. Our thought, though, is, again, that projects have contingency amounts built in them, that there would be some flexibility there, that projects would be able to be managed within the available appropriation, and we think that is a reasonable approach.
Well, Mr. Merkins brings up the question that if it's kind of an average, how are you going to get the highs and lows taken care of? Should there be a separate account that inflation dumped in this? You can spread it out over those highs and lows, or how are you logistically going to accommodate those?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, we were suggesting applying the average to each and every construction project, and that would be the size of the budget. It was not our intent to create a separate pool that then projects could come back to and have some sort of review process or argue for more or less. Again, we didn't want to set up a sequence where we had three different sets of numbers for the same project, that we had the governor's recommending an inflation amount of such. The House maybe had a different. The Senate had a different. We thought it's difficult enough to put together a bonding bill without arguing over small variations in the inflation amount for the same projects.
Just a follow-up. I see in the University of Minnesota there's four projects that would fall into that category, and I think in Minsky there are five, so we're not talking huge amounts of pulling back, but I can understand where they may have taken the easy route instead of the honest route.
Thank you. Representative Knobloch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Merkins, on the inflation, when you're doing this, you are then projecting some inflation into the future, not knowing precisely if it will be there or not. And I know that many of these projects, it takes a while for them to get underway. I mean, you know, we may appropriate money for it now, but it may be a year before we actually really start spending any money on the project. If the inflation that was projected doesn't materialize, does the administration or the Department of Finance go to those projects and say, you've got 8.6% less than we were going to originally give you since we haven't had this inflation? Is there any adjustment?
Mr. Merkins.
Mr. Chairman, members, no, there's no way for us to circle back after the fact and say arbitrarily reduce the size of the appropriation that had otherwise been awarded by the legislature. Whatever the appropriation size is, that is the amount that they are authorized in law to proceed with. If for some reason there's less inflation than what had been put into that cost estimate, it gives them more flexibility in their budget, and maybe that gets balanced off by other costs that show up elsewhere through the course of the project.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Merkins, I understand that there wouldn't be a way to do that with the legislature if you're giving money to a city that was building a building, or maybe the Minsky system, which is separate statutorily, but what about state agencies? And the Department of Finance has the authority to rein in those costs for state agencies, do they not?
Mr.
Chairman, members, the Department of Finance, as a normal role, does not review the ongoing costs that are associated with these projects. We're not project managers. We don't have an ongoing review role once the appropriation is awarded. Our level of involvement is making sure they have matching funds involved and making sure that they are following the provisions of the appropriation bill. They're doing what they set out to do. We as a matter of course have not yet put ourselves in a position where we monitor on an ongoing basis how the agencies spend their appropriations for their projects. That would be a new endeavor for us.
Well, Mr. Chair, just an editorial comment. Maybe the Department of Finance isn't the right place for it, but it would seem to me that it might be right for someone somewhere to circle back and check that.
Mr. Merkins, and we'll recognize Mr. Gordon. Do you have reason to believe that all these projects are delayed a year? I mean, or are they? Are some of these going to get still completed earlier than that? Or do you think that, you know, sort of goes to that cash flow equation that you have? Are these projects going to happen faster because now some of them are, like some of the Minsky HEPA projects, I know they actually had bids, they were just chomping at the bit, ready to go. What do you envision happening?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I think there are examples where some small subset of projects have been able to advance to some extent in this one-year absence. Some projects have been privately funded. Other projects, maybe if they were in the design phase, were able to complete their design and get ready for their construction appropriation. But my instincts are that is the exception rather than the rule. My instincts are that most of the projects were pretty much stopped when the appropriation bill didn't happen last time. So, I think we're sort of back to where we started with only sort of a few exceptions, and maybe Mr. Goodwin wanted to add to that.
Mr. Chairman, members, let me give you an example. If in 2004 project was budgeted for $10 million, it already had built-in escalation rates of when it was going to start to be built and complete construction. What this 8.63% average rate is doing is catching up the time between 2004 and 2005 for the explosion in the construction market for materials mainly. So it's a catch-up, so that $10 million becomes 8.63% more, so that if a project for Minsky goes out to bid in June or July, that it has the funds appropriately for the materials for a science project or a student union or something because of this influx of the increase in the market.
Well, to that point, Mr. Goodwin, do you think then the projects last year perhaps didn't have the right cost escalator in them?
They had the appropriate, if you had passed the bonding bill in 2004 and they would have started construction, and then they would have, if the contractors had not purchased their materials early, they would be in a situation where they would be asking for more money. So there would have been another fiasco in the marketplace. You wouldn't have had enough money to complete the project. Or the contractors would have to honor the contract and complete it, but then maybe, you know, possibly go broke.
Representative Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Knobloch's question. I think I understand the nature of your concern, although I was surprised on that cancellation sheet, the number of projects where money came back towards the state, the appropriation, when we were looking at that, of projects that actually were completed but didn't need the extra amount. So I guess that's one way to track that. I mean, I think I'm getting the drift of your concern, though, that, you know, you could conceivably have a project that gets a windfall out of this blanket inflationary increase. But I guess the only way we can track that is to look back at, you know, hopefully we're passing a bill here that we'll get agreement on and get the governor's signature on, and then track it backwards from that to see if we were on or off on this assumption.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, quick.
Representative Knobloch.
Well, I guess my concern is I think that, not in every case, but what I think often does happen, and members will probably remember, I've been critical at what I think is the cost of building some of our state buildings. I think that we spend more money building them than we should. I think that at times, if a agency realizes they have more money than they need, they go out and they find additional bells and whistles they want to add to the building. They put in nicer stuff. They do something that they otherwise wouldn't have done if they didn't have the extra money available. And so you don't see it in a cancellation report, but that doesn't mean that it's not money that we couldn't have gotten back in some other way. And it's very hard to monitor that.
Other questions before we move on?
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And Mr. Merkins, please continue.
All right, moving along then. I will say this, that while we were applying an average for these various projects from the governor's standpoint, there's one exception to that, and I'll make note of that for Representative Smith's benefit, I believe. The Department of Correction, the Faribault Prison Project, that's one project where we felt swayed by maybe the frame of thought that Representative Solberg was on, that that the individual project had such a compelling story that it needed additional inflation. That project having being a very major project that had a fairly long time frame, also a project very heavily in the use of concrete and steel, that was something that we felt was one project worthy of moving away from the average and actually going to a project specific estimate for that. So that project in the governor's recommendation was inflated by 13% rather than the 8.63%. So I just wanted to make you aware of that. Moving on to higher education, if I may. So,
please.
Higher education, the governor increased higher education funding in his 2005 package by $35 million. The effect of that was to essentially equalize both MNSQ and the U of M at $100 million in his funding recommendations. He added a funding request for the academic health facilities at the University of Minnesota Minneapolis campus at $10.4 million. Also added a piece of the Morris District facility request at 2.9. As members may recall, that was a two-part request. Part of it was for a biomass burner that would provide heat to the Morris campus. The governor recommended that. The governor, however, did not recommend funds for the football stadium, the second portion of that request. The governor recommended increasing the U of M HEPR amount from $38 million to $45.1 million. HEPR, again, Higher Education Asset Preservation and Replacement Account, the garden variety asset preservation that we give to higher education. The governor also added $2 million in funding for the MNSQ classroom technology upgrade request. That was a lump sum request. Those projects, that would fund approximately five projects, about $400,000 each. The governor added funding for the remodeling of MNSQ science facilities generally, increased his recommendation from $3 million to $9.7 million. That was full funding amount. That would provide about 33,000 square feet at 17 campuses. Again, these are projects that by and large are $500,000 or less. That would increase the basically renovate and remodel the science facilities for nursing, allied health, and basic science programs for a variety of MinSCU campuses. So that is a subset of changes in the governor's higher ed package. Under human services, the governor added a new request of $12.6 million for design and construction of a secure nursing facility with beds for up to 50 sexual offenders. That is a new request in terms of requests in 2005 that were not necessarily in the 2004 package, but this is a request that's been, at least the need for this has been discussed going back to the 2003 session, as I recall. Essentially, the idea is to build a secure nursing facility for a variety of folks, sexual psychopathic personalities, sexual dangerous persons, mentally ill and dangerous, that due to age and illness require a nursing facility, but it needs to be a secure nursing facility, not just a typical nursing facility. And also on occasion, commitments from the Department of Correction, inmates that need skilled nursing care but need it in a secured environment as well. So the governor is recommending both design and construction funding for that project. The location of that is not yet set that I'm aware of. The Department of Human Services is looking at criteria that they would use to review proposals that might come from different communities that might be interested in hosting that particular project. And I should mention for either this project or the other projects that I'll go through, if you have questions, specific questions on the project themselves that I can't answer if you want to go into more detail, spokespeople from the various agencies are here in attendance, and I can call them up on an as-needed.
I have a question on a point, Representative Howes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Merkins, my first question would be, where did you get the $12.6 million figure? Could you supply it to the chair and to us? Is the building, land, utilities, could you break that down in some fashion so we know where you came up with the $12.6 million?
Mr. Merkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howes, as this project is not site-specific, that's kind of difficult to do. I mean, I think what we're looking at is an order of magnitude number here. We're assuming design for a facility of that size would be a little over $1 million. Construction and equip, maybe $11.5 million. These are estimates that were prepared by the Department of Human Services. But again, without knowing the exact site, it's kind of difficult to be able to supply exact figures for the various line items within that overall amount. But we think as an order of magnitude number, this would be sufficient to do that number of beds in a secure facility.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up to that. In your explanation of this, in your introduction, you mentioned different different type of residents in this facility. You mentioned sex offenders, but I think you also said mentally ill. Was that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members, that's my understanding, yes. Mentally ill and dangerous.
Representative House.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I find that phrase a little difficult at this point in time because of the fact that the governor is moving to community-based settings and closing all our rural treatment centers because of a court case, federal court case here a few years back, that you needed to remove the resident from the institutional setting of mental illness to a community-based setting in order to capture the federal dollars. So if we're still going to have them in an institutional setting, would we then lose the federal dollars in that case? And then I also noticed today, and I unfortunately didn't bring it with me, there was a legislative report, I can't remember which agency did it, but was recommending that the state put more money in. The report was on sexual predators and civil commitments. So the report said we should put more money into community-based settings. And again, this community-based setting keeps coming up. And when I refer to community-based, that means 17 residents or less. I guess this would be a question for the gentleman that just probably walked up, and you can answer it later. I don't want to hold the Capital Investment Committee long. But if they are recommending more money into community-based settings, that's telling me then that even though the governor has this idea of a forensic nursing facility of 50, which is, it makes sense. But if we want to put more money into community-based settings, that means then that we're moving possibly sexual predators, level 3, level 2, to a community-based setting. That's just right back to me. A community-based setting is a nursing home again. It seems like we're circling the wagons and winding right back up where we started from in the beginning.
Mr. Merkins, do you wish to punt?
I will punt.
Please identify yourself with the tape and respond to the Bob Ness-like question. did I say that? I'm sorry. I apologize.
I look at that as a compliment, Mr. Chairman.
I love Ness. I had to bring him up. He laid the base.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Wes Koistra, and I'm from the Department of Human Services. And in
say your name again?
Wes Koistra. In response to the question about community-based care, I wanted to separate some populations that we serve and tend to serve in this particular nursing facility. We serve sexual offenders in our forensics units. We serve people who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous, and then we serve another population that is committed as having serious and persistent mental illness, but is not committed as mentally ill and dangerous or as sex offenders. It is the latter population that we are developing community-based services for, and we're our population for in terms of serving sex offenders and people who are committed mentally ill and dangerous is growing. The segment of that group that needs nursing home care is also growing, and that's the reason for this request for a new facility serving 50 individuals. We would not, I'm trying to remember all the questions, we are not anticipating receiving federal financial participation for this group because of the reasons you stated, that they would be on a campus and they would not meet the federal requirements for federal financial participation. And in regard to an earlier question you had about what was assumed in the cost, we assumed that the location of this facility would be on one of our campuses, but we hadn't selected which campus, so that infrastructure was not part of the cost to this facility. We have a number of options of where we could locate this nursing facility. There's other campus reuse studies going on because we are downsizing as a result of the mentally ill population, and there are a number of communities that are looking at the reuse plans for those facilities, so some facilities may not be available to us based upon what those reuse plans are end up being. Others will be. And I think I've hit most of your questions. Please help me if I've missed a couple.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Koistra?
Koistra.
Koistra? Thank you. Your name has popped up in conversations a lot lately with different people I've talked to, so I'm glad to meet you finally. So the 12.6 is basic. The thought is it would go somewhere where there's probably state-owned property and some kind of services already provided, power, electric, sewer, water, and that kind of thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. That'd be all for now.
Thank you, Representative Howes. Other questions for Mr. Koistra before he leaves? Seeing none, Mr. Merkins, please continue.
Moving on to Veterans Affairs, the governor also recommended an additional amount for the World War II Veterans Memorial on the State Capitol Mall, increasing his recommendations from $500,000 to $670,000 to match available private funding. My understanding is there's about $150,000 worth of private funding that this would match. Part of that is inflation-driven, but part of it is just the extra cost. When we do these monuments and memorials on the Capitol Mall, we now try to build in at least a small amount of ongoing maintenance funding, a reserve account, if you will, so that not only do we build them, but we also have the capacity to maintain them in the future. This would do all of the above. Moving on to the Department of Natural Resources, at the department's request, $3 million was added for In the Department of Natural Resources, the governor added $3 million for Greater Minnesota Regional Parks. He did that out of concern to balance off the amount of funding that was being recommended for Metro Regional Parks and to provide some balance with Greater Minnesota. Also, at the request of DNR, provided an additional $2.5 million in asset preservation, and that was offset by reducing field office renovations by $200,000 and removing an office facilities development request of $2.3 million. Those two requests would likely show up in the 2006 cycle rather than being asked to be funded in 2005. And the governor also added $150,000 to remove and rebuild the Albert Lee Dam on the Cedar River in Freeborn County, I'm told.
Shell River. Cedar River would be in Austin, but close enough for government.
Sorry about that. Page 2, Board of Water and Soil Resources. The governor increased the amount of CREP funding by $1 million to move the administration of the program administration money from $2 million to $3 million. That would provide an overall recommendation of $23 million. As members may recall, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program has a significant federal match. I believe it's somewhere in the vicinity of $200 million or more. This would provide 120,000 acres under the CREP program. The reason the governor increased the funding amount, particularly for administrative costs, is the farm bill that implemented the program that provides the federal funding has an expiration date. All easements under the CREP program have to be processed by December 31st of 2007. That date is the same date this year as it was last year. Unfortunately, we lost a year in the interim, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources has less time to meet that federal deadline, so we wanted to provide them additional administrative resources to do that. Under the Public Facilities Authority, the governor reduced his recommendations.
Mr. Merkins, let's hop back up to Bowser for a second and CREP. Language hasn't necessarily changed from the governor's position, though, on length of easements.
Mr. Chairman, I think the governor's position has always been that he would prefer permanent easements, but in negotiations with our federal counterparts, I think we arrived at an agreement, and my understanding is the governor is willing to abide by where we arrived at with that, a mixture of permanent and non-permanent easements. Short answer, yes, Mr. Chairman. I think the language in the governor's bill is the same as it was last time. Under the Public Facilities Authority, the governor reduced his funding request for the Drinking Water Wastewater Loan and Grant Program from $16.3 million to $14.4 million. That was to reflect fewer federal matching funds. We try to make sure that we fund up to the amount of federal matching funds that are available in federal appropriation bills. We thought the federal funding would be somewhere in the $24 million range. Unfortunately, the federal funding now appears to be in the $20 million range. So the governor reduced the state funding recommendation to mirror that reduction in federal matching funds. Under the
Representative Broad has a question / comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Merkins, how would it work if we decided to fund that at a higher rate without the federal matching equivalent in terms of the amount that they've given us in the past?
Mr. Chair, members, if you funded it at a higher level, you would have that extra state appropriation amount to be able to be used for that purpose, whether it's loans or grants. It's just that it wouldn't bring in a like amount of federal funding.
Please continue.
Under the Veterans Homes Board, the governor added a funding request for the Laverne Veterans Homes, a dementia wander area. Members, I believe you, many of you in past years toured the Silver Bay Veterans Home and saw the dementia wander area there that was recently constructed that was funded. This would do the same thing at the Laverne Veterans Home. Department of Administration, the governor eliminated his recommendation for the Cooperative Local Facilities Grant Program. That's a $15 million request he had last year. I think the administration still feels that that's a valuable program. It's a good thought, but did not generate much legislative interest last year, and the governor decided to, I think, just basically let that one go. Also within the Department of Administration, the governor reduced his general fund request for agency relocation costs. Part of that agency relocation cost, as you may recall, was spun off to the deficiency bill. The relocation costs for the Departments of Agriculture and Health are to be provided for in a deficiency bill through the sale of the Department of Health building on the U of M campus. What is not funded in the deficiency bill is other relocation costs for other agencies, including the Department of Human Services, there's some relocation that needs to go on with work in the Veterans Services Building, and other relocation costs are recommended here as well. In the transportation area, the governor recommended increasing the size of the appropriation for the repair to the exterior of the MnDOT building here in St. Paul. This is a project request that's been around a couple of years, and in the past, it was thought that we could perhaps phase this particular request. Unfortunately, the condition of the facade of the MnDOT building is getting worse, and there's concern that it's a safety hazard. Members may recall the exterior of the MnDOT building is 3-inch granite panels that each weigh a half a ton. They're held up on the building by metal clips. Those clips over the years have gotten rusted, and also as water has gotten behind the granite panels and the water has frozen, it's pushing the panels out farther and farther all the time. And at some point, this is going to be a health safety issue if it's not already. And the governor is recommending full funding to take care of it once and for all. Department of Transportation eliminated the MnDOT analog to digital conversion request. That's something that the agency is looking at trying to fund within existing Trunk Highway Fund resources. Also changed the funding source for small capital projects at MnDOT from the Trunk Highway Fund, from cash to Trunk Highway Bonding, to put less pressure under the Trunk Highway Fund at the moment. And then finally, two additional requests that the governor had not recommended in 2004 is now recommending $1.5 million for the failing corridor in St. Paul, and also $2 million for the Holman Field Airport. I think both of those governor's funding amounts are certainly not enough to complete the project. Both of those projects would require substantially more non-state funding to be matched, might even require some additional state funding for that matter. But the governor wanted to see that those two projects be put into play, so to speak, with the idea being that perhaps a discussion could occur through the course of this session, and the exact split of funding sources could be worked out. And so these are two new project requests that the governor did not have last year.
Mr. Merkins, on Holman Field, is that fair to ring up St. Paul for that one, or isn't that a MAC project, or why?
Mr. Chairman, it could be any of the above. I know at least last year they were talking about a project cost somewhere in the vicinity of $25 million. Now, that cost may have gone up, but the idea being is that it could involve financial participation from a number of different sources: state participation, city participation, maybe private participation, as well as potential participation from MAC, as well as possibly from the state airports fund. So I don't think the governor has necessarily tried to nail down all those pieces at specific dollar amounts, but just wanted to make sure that some amount of state funding was contributed toward it and the discussion would unfold.
Is that request coming from the city of St. Paul, or who's making the request?
Mr. Chairman and members, that request has always come from the city of St. Paul. It was part of their, both the Failing Corridor and Holman Field project were both part of their 2004 request package and continue to be now.
Thank you.
So that...
Good request. They have to be. I'm sure they're excellent requests.
So that, members, is a brief update of newer additional project recommendations that the governor had this year compared to last year. The other, I think, part of this equation is then comparing the governor's recommendations to perhaps, I say perhaps, where the House either was at or might be at. Or what I've done is I've put together a spreadsheet that compares the governor's recommendation to either the House 2004 end of session or House File 3. I do this comparison not because I know what the outcome is going to be of House File 3, but I didn't have anything else to compare it to, so I thought at least that would be a way to have a discussion on the matter. Total funding in the governor's bill, obviously higher than what was in the House 2004 end of session, also higher than what is in House File 3. To just kind of highlight some of those differences and maybe to make a pitch for some of those projects that didn't make the House bill last time. And I'll try not to be whiny about it. I'll try to be matter of fact. If I cross that line, let me know and I'll step back. And I can always invite the agencies up too if they can say this better than I. Again, the governor added inflation, and that was something that that's not in House File 3 at the moment. In the higher education area, curiously enough, the governor is higher on U of M recommendations. The governor at $100 million. House File 3 at about $80 million. The House is higher on the Minsky side. The House at $129 million. The governor at $100 million. So the governor was at $100 for both institutions. House File 3, a little bit lower on the U of M, a little bit higher on Minsky. If you look back historically, there is variability in terms of what those two institutions usually end up with in bills, and there have been some years where both the U of M and Minsky have been given appropriations at the same dollar amounts, and then there have been other years where Minsky has been given a little, if not significantly more, than the U of M. So it's varied over time. The governor's recommendation is to provide equal funding for both. On the K-12 education side, the governor recommended some funding for Purpose Center. There's nothing in the House bill at the moment. House also had minimum recommendations for the Department of Education. The governor had recommended the Grant Magnet School up in Duluth. That is to replace funding that Duluth had gotten for that project in the 2002 bill, but lost it in the 2003 unallotment process. Also, the governor recommended funding for the Red Lake School. And both the governor and the House recommended money for the land acquisition, remaining land acquisition costs for the Crosswinds Middle School in Woodbury. So those are the differences there. North Star, if I understood correctly, the House end of session had nothing in for North Star. House File 3 has, I assume, a placeholder is $10 million. I'm not sure exactly what that's for. Maybe an author could talk to that. The governor recommended at 37.5. I think much has been said about the North Star project, and I don't think I'm going to talk about it today. We have representatives of MnDOT here if you want to go through it. But at least that's the way the differences kind of line up.
I think there'll be plenty of time to discuss North Star. I got a feeling before the end of session, and you know, House File 3 is interesting, but I wouldn't look at it as much more than a placeholder, so it's kind of, you know,
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. Actually, on I would think maybe on at least three different projects, North Star, the Faribault Prison, and the zoo. Those are three significant projects that seem to have some difference of opinion in terms of how the governor and the House had lined up before. I don't know what your project schedule is, Mr. Chairman. I presume you'll talk more at when I'm done. But if you do have time to hear from any of those three agencies talking about those three projects, I would personally think that might be helpful for committee members, so I might make a pitch for that.
I think we'll probably wait for that additional conversation to occur after the finance committees make their recommendation to us, because I don't think we should prejudge what those committees will do. But if members want to hear on something on a particular project, far be it from me to stop them. But all right, Mr. Chairman. President Knobloch actually may have had a question at one point.
Chair, thank you. Mr. Merkins, you know, we've talked about the dollar figures, but I was wondering if you could talk a little about a couple of the language items that were in the back of the governor's bill. Specifically, there was a transfer of some money from, I think, Minnesota Housing to HESO, and then there was something on page 24 of the bill about dedicating a certain amount of the working capital expenditures from the general fund somewhere. Can you talk about the language portions of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, sure, and there might be a couple other sections if we're talking about language items that I also might want to bring to the committee's attention. The HESO transfer is a new addition to the governor's bonding bill that was not there in 2004. I'll try to make a long story short if I can. This does not affect GO bonding or any sort of general obligation appropriations that would come from this committee. There's a number of different financial instruments out there, and general obligation bonding is one type of bond. There are other tax-exempt bonds that governments can issue in Minnesota. Because they're exempt from federal income taxation, the federal government puts caps on a per capita basis on the amount of those bonds that each individual state can issue. And when I'm talking about those other types of tax-exempt bonds, they're primarily revenue bonds. They include such things as industrial revenue bonds, single-family mortgage bonds, residential rental bonds, certain public facility bonds for local units of government projects. So there's agricultural bonds and agricultural loans. In this case, the state of Minnesota has a limit on the amount of those bonds that can be issued. Under state statute, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency gets a certain entitlement authority allotment each year, each calendar year, and they can use that for housing purposes. Usually they use it for single-family mortgage revenue bonds. On occasion, they use it for residential rental bonds. In this case, what we've seen in Minnesota is sort of a slowdown in demand for these tax-exempt revenue bonds, they are not in as high a demand as they were just a few years ago, and I think we attribute that to the economy. In the case of this Housing Finance Agency, they have their entitlement authority allocation, but they think that they will be unable to use, I think, $50 million, as that's what's specified in the bill. They will be able to use $50 million of that authority, so they were willing to transfer that authority to the Higher Education Services Office, HESO, for HESO to use for student loan bonds to basically buy down the rates of student loans. So the thought was there is this Housing Finance Agency couldn't use their entire allotment. Let HESO take a part of the authority and use it for something that HESO is ready to use.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Merkins, obviously, apparently the federal government permits us to do that then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, the federal government sets a general framework for what type of bonds you can use your state-by-state authority on. All those are eligible uses. From there, state statutes pick up, and state statutes dictate how that per-state amount is divvied up to different uses. This particular change would amend the state statutes on a one-time basis to allow that transfer.
All right.
Great. Thank you. Representative Tinglestad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You kind of threw me a softball there with mentioning North Star and wanting to discuss it, so I got to just take this quick opportunity to say I'm at your service on North Star and any additional information that members are looking for. Just three quick points. It's cost-effective. In fact, for every $1 of state money, it'll bring in $1.50 of federal money. And lastly, it's the fastest-growing corridor in Minnesota, so we need to address some of those problems. So with that, I'm at your service, Mr. Chair.
Happy to have you there.
Thank you.
Representative Garofalo, did you have a question, comment, or suggestion?
Just more of a comment, Mr. Chairman, that I know some members of the committee have probably heard these discussions many times before, and I don't want to speak on behalf of all the three freshman members of the committee, but some of us are, you know, we're new to the process and would certainly enjoy any opportunity we could to learn about these projects, whether they're divisive or not.
Oh, I don't disagree with you. Freshmen might want to count their blessings in not knowing about that. At the end of session, we will be very well. You'll be very well versed. But if you want, is there one particular one you want to hear something briefly about today? Is that what you're suggesting? I don't have a problem with it. So.
No, the.
I thought we'd wait till after the fourth when the finance committee made the recommendation. But if we got people here, and there's something new, you know, if you want to hear about the zoo in particular or the North Star, you know, we're here to learn.
Mr. Chairman, the testifier mentioned that I don't know if, I guess maybe something like North Star or something like the zoo, that almost sounds like a one-hour discussion. Are my expectations of that?
1 hour?
Well, no, 1 hour just of informational, I guess, is what I was looking for. But
I think the North Star would be lengthy, but...
Oh, not too bad. It's only 40 miles.
I want to make sure that I'm showing proper deference and respect to the highly respected chairman before I make any suggestions in public, but the but I did, yeah. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be quiet now.
Representative Knobloch was going to comment before you, and then we'll certainly hear from Representative Hausman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to monopolize the conversation, but going back to this language issue, if I can, Mr. Merkins. First, you know, it might be interesting for the committee to know if we can transfer $50 million out of the housing fund to student loans. You know, I don't have anything against student loans, and that might be a really good place to put it, but just where else could we transfer it? I mean, it might be kind of interesting to know. So do you know, or could you provide us with that information?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, it's not that we're transferring money out of the housing fund.
No, it's just the authority. I understand.
Right, the authority. I'd be happy to provide to the chair and members the we have a one pager that specifies exactly on a calendar year basis the overall amount of entitlement authority that or allocation authority that the state of Minnesota has, and all the eligible uses and the amount of available authority that's allocated to each one of those uses, so we could provide that to the committee.
Well, thank you. I think that would be interesting.
You Representative Knobloch, just for your reference and for other committee members, I thought that once we assembled the bill and got it out of here, we still have work to do before the end of session. I thought it might be, at that time, beneficial to have him come back and actually talk to us about, you know, our overall tax-free capacity and also that breakdown. We might want to take a peek at, you know, is that allocation correct or should we make adjustments to it? Because I noticed the same thing and learned a little bit about it. This seems innocuous, but I think it's something that we might want to all at least understand better, but I'm not sure that we need to understand it, you know, before we get the bill out. But I think it's an issue that we want to visit this year.
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to visit this year. I guess it depends somewhat on whether it would be something that would be in this bonding bill or not. But, you know, if it's an item item of language in this bonding bill that we're going to be putting together now, I think it would be interesting to know about it in advance. I guess the other
if we have time perhaps to do that or wouldn't, you know. Okay. I think we should look at it.
Okay, the other thing, if I could, Mr. Merkins, on page 24, there's some language redefining what the maximum current cash flow requirement is. And I'm wondering, what does that do?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Peter Salzman from the Department of Finance. Representative Knobloch, this is language that the Department of Finance requests to be changed in state law. It's the state short... If the state has to do short-term borrowing for cash flow purposes, the cash flow amount that we can borrow is regulated under federal tax law. In the early 1980s, the old language was put into the statutes to comply with federal tax law of the early 1980s. Since that time, federal tax law has changed and the regulations have changed, and this language that's in here now complies with the new federal tax law, so that if we do short-term borrowing, we don't have a discrepancy between federal law and state law.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hausman, I believe you were...
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, continuing on, Faribault Prison Expansion, that's the next project on the list that hasn't lined up precisely between the governor and the House. I believe the House File 3 has partial funding of $34.9 million in for the Faribault Prison Expansion. The governor has full funding at the revised inflated rate of $84.8 million. Just for members' benefit, particularly new members, this is this is one you could spend a whole meeting, a whole day on, and that might not be a bad idea, but for purposes of today, just in a nutshell, this is a two-phase project. The Faribault Prison project would, when it's completed, both phases would fund five new units, about 416 beds each at the Faribault Prison, plus additional facilities for kitchen and dining facilities. It would demolish a significant number of buildings at the Faribault campus. The Faribault campus has very old buildings that don't work programmatically for the corrections department and the type of people that they're trying to incarcerate, and would add somewhere, I think, in the vicinity of 1,000 beds overall when done. I think I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Wilkins, I noticed there's a difference between the governor's request and the Senate bill as well. Do you know what the difference happens to be? Not that we are overly concerned about what they're doing over in the Senate, but we like to know.
Mr. Chairman, members, I haven't been involved in a direct discussion with the chair of the Senate Capital Investment Committee on this point, but my vague understanding is he would suggest that the project not be funded in full in this phase, but rather some, perhaps most of it would, but certain pieces would not be done this year, but we rolled into their 2006 request. So he's not providing full funding this year. He would jettison a piece of it and roll that into the funding request in 2006.
Perhaps that's one of the items that you could have someone from the Department of Corrections maybe could come down and briefly enlighten us on.
Mr. On Benson the, is on his way.
And Representative Garofalo would be sitting on happy. We're going to talk about one of the projects. You're happy. Knowledge is good.
Mr. Chair and members, My name is Dennis Benson. I'm a deputy commissioner for the Department of Corrections.
Welcome, Mr. Benson.
Thank you.
Hold it, please. Wait. Witty comment.
Yes, it is a witty comment.
No, see, witty.
Representative Galafo, I... yeah, I got your name wrong. I'm sorry. I've only said it for a dozen times. See, I came in with our esteemed chair as a new member, and it would be a toss-up between he or I who asked the most dumb questions that year.
Oh.
And I'm going to give my vote to him.
So
don't feel bad. Yes, but we're pikers compared to like other people that came in with us that might be on.
Now they're calling
sitting
me
over on your side of the aisle, looking away. But anyway, we digress, as we will probably do often.
Mr. Chair and members, the issue with respect to the $71 million amount that the Senate has in their bill currently, and we haven't had a lot of conversation with the Senate, although on the other hand, they don't fund the segregation unit either, which is another issue from our perspective. But the $71 million would not build three living units, which is our plan in phase one. We really need pretty much the $84 million to build three units outside of the perimeter, consistent, those of you that attended our little mini tour yesterday, and then phase two would build the last two living units inside the facility. So anything less than the 84, we're going to be struggling to get three units built. If it ended up at that lower number, then we probably have to settle for two units this time and try to get the three done next time, and that becomes somewhat problematic in terms of our growth. And also the bonding bill next year will be almost as large as it is this year for just the Faribault project. So there are some issues from our perspective in terms of the number and getting three units versus two units.
Representative Demmer, perhaps I should have went to you earlier. I think you were on the list, were you not? Perhaps that doesn't involve this, but...
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I apologize for not including
that's
you
okay. I was enjoying the conversation. I do have a question for Mr. Merkins, if I could. Looking back into the bill here, into creation of accounts, there is some change made to Greater Minnesota Redevelopment accounts that were put in the past is being changed to Minnesota Development accounts. And looking forward through the bill, there's all kinds of changes, basically changing that to be a development account for all of Minnesota, as opposed to Greater Minnesota, which excluded the 7-county metro area, and now it's for all of. Can you speak to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, this program has had some fluidity over the years on whether it would be for all of Minnesota or whether it be just for Greater Minnesota. At one time, it was for all of Minnesota. Then, during the Ventura administration, the statutes were changed to, if I remember correctly, to only allow this particular grant program for Greater Minnesota. The idea at that time was provide the redevelopment grant program for Greater Minnesota only, but then also to provide an equal amount of funding in the metro area for the livable communities grant program. So there was, at that time, there was a thought that there should be a balance, livable communities in the metro area, redevelopment in Greater Minnesota. Now it's come full circle where the recommendation is to fund it, call it the development account to provide more flexibility and uses, but more importantly, to have that funding available for both the metro area as well as Greater Minnesota, as there is not a funding request for both the metro area as well as Greater Minnesota, as there is not a funding request for livable communities in this package.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Benson. Many of us have been... on the committee have dealt with construction projects. I do it even in my real job. And one of the in the conversations about the Faribault prison at 71 was talking about staging it. I'm sure you're much more familiar with the prison itself and the construction of the five units that you're going to try to do. So could you explain to the committee, as a construction worker, we've started in on a project, say they're apartment complexes, and we start at the east end and we start building west, we'll take a couple of, we'll lay all the foundations out, and then we'll come back to the far end and we'll start putting up the stick walls and the plumbing and the heating and keep going as we get each one done. We've got all the foundations laid down. Why couldn't the prison be done in a situation where you laid out all three or all five foundations, came back to the first foundation, put your stick walls up, and then keep going, staging it that way? Could you please explain that to the committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I'll do my best. The phase one of this project, if you can envision an oval-like perimeter, which is our existing perimeter, and remember now we have over 1,200 offenders down there. And one of the issues here, one of the challenges with respect to this expansion project is to expand in a way where we don't have to lower the population simply because we have no other place to put them other than to go out and rent another bed, which of course is very expensive. So we want to do this expansion in a way that doesn't disrupt the operation of that facility to any greater degree than necessary. So our plan and our approach to this, and we've worked certainly with our architect on this and in the pre-design phase, is to build the first three cottages outside of the existing perimeter. And we would do precisely what you suggest, of course, build the three foundations and set the cells and complete that portion of the project. And then we would bring the perimeter down around those three units and move offenders down into them and then go back inside the existing facility now, the existing original perimeter, and do some demolition where we're going to build housing units and complete the last two. We'd also in that phase one go inside and I believe build the a food service area. We've got a food service building that needs to be built right now. We're feeding out of three separate kitchens down there. So that would be completed, and I believe there might be some minor demolition occurring too. So it would be very difficult for us to put the foundations in for all five because of the two phase and doing it outside the perimeter. And as we go back inside, we would also create a temporary perimeter inside so that we could kind of cordon off the construction area. Of course, we've got escape issues, we've got tool issues, tool control issues, all of those kinds of issues, too, that we would have to contend with. So this is a challenging project from that perspective. But again, at the end of the day, we double the size of that facility. We address millions and millions of dollars of asset preservation needs. We add these beds at a very minimal cost, $43, $44 a day. We address the staff safety issues, the inmate safety issues. We give the taxpayers a real bang for the buck. And we have beds then that will last us into the end of the first decade of the new century.
Representative Mahoney.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't necessarily want to hear it now, but as having talked to a good number of people who have worked at Oak Park and at Stillwater, it would be interesting for the rest of the committee to hear about the security concerns you have when construction workers are coming in. It is a nightmare trying to get into your prison, a law-abiding citizen trying to get in, and then trying to get out because it takes an awful lot of work on the construction company's part to do the security of getting a person in that's carrying sharp tools and a variety of other things and then getting them out and accounting for it all. But I don't know that you want to get into it right here because of time constraints, but it would be interesting later on.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, just very quickly, you're absolutely right in terms of the challenges that presents. we don't allow traffic in and out of the facility until a count clears so that we know we've got all of our offenders, then the trucks can move out or move in. And the tool control, sharp instrument control with cranes and ladders and all of those kinds of things, that really does add a challenge for the agency. We also are required to require ourselves to do background checks on all the workers. That changes from day to day. So there are those are also some cost drivers and things that can't be ignored when we try to understand the cost and the inflation factors and all those other things. But it's an excellent point, and as the one of the primary functions of the agency is public safety, we certainly don't want to have a problem during an expansion or construction.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yesterday at Lionel Lakes, you had mentioned some savings in operating costs. Unfortunately, I didn't take notes of that. I was just wondering if you could repeat those numbers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, one of the real savers here is the fact that the way of the corrections industry in today's world is to build prison complexes. And I mentioned that to a couple of you yesterday, but Colorado, for example, has an area of probably 5 square miles where they actually have 7 or 8 different facilities. In Phoenix, or just outside of Phoenix, there's a corrections complex that actually has 6 prisons inside of 1 perimeter. And if you have to lock people up, and we do, and our population is going up and it's going to continue to, we ought to do that as economically as possible. And adding to that existing infrastructure, that existing, you already have a warden, you have the maintenance staff, you have the accounting staff, we have the human resource staff, we have all of that infrastructure there. And to add beds to an existing physical plant is far, far cheaper than going out and duplicating that in the middle of a cornfield in greater Minnesota, or going out and renting those beds somewhere else. The marginal cost of adding beds at Faribault is somewhere around $43 to $45 a day, as compared to, again, going out and building a standalone facility or renting, which is going to be closer to that $70, $75 a day mark. We're doubling the size of that facility, and we are adding somewhere between 45 and 50% more staff. So that gives you some idea of the economy of scale of doing it at an existing physical plant as opposed to starting all over somewhere. So this will drop the Faribault per diem by, I believe, somewhere between $8 and $10 a day, and it will dramatically drop the departmental per diem. Obviously, our total budget is going up, unfortunately. But if it has to go up, we ought to do it in a way that really does preserve as much of those dollars as possible for the really effective things like education, like prevention programs, and all of those other things that I think we want to spend our money on.
Thanks.
Thank you. Are there other questions on the Faribault Prison where we have our good friend Mr. Benson there, or no? Seeing none, thank you. We appreciate that very much. And Mr. Merkins, do you have more?
I will wrap up on page 2, Mr. Chairman. The final page.
Perfect.
Environmental agencies, just to kind of go through the side-by-side again, on Department of Natural Resources, the governor had $70 million, the House in the $52 million range, a number of different project requests within the DNR package accounted for that difference. On the Minnesota Zoo, the House had no funding for the zoo initiative. The governor is recommending $20.6 million. For new members, that is a major new exhibit proposal proposed by the zoo. It has two major parts. It has a gateway to the North Trail, and the second part is renovations and remodeling, redesign of their biodiversity center. Biodiversity center is their main building at the zoo. And basically, the Gateway to the North Trail would be a trail that would provide a number of new visitor enhancements. It would allow the visitors to go down a trail that would mirror what it would be like walking through northeastern Asia in terms of the kind of animals that would be seen there, bears, Amur leopards, wild boars, otters, and I'm probably missing a few critters along the way. So this is one that the governor and the House hasn't lined up particularly well so far. People from the zoo are here today if you want to go through that request, but at least at a summary level that that I'd point out that difference.
Great, thank you.
On Department of Administration, and finally, Department of Administration as an agency, you know, I suppose there's that spectrum where some agencies are probably going to get very well taken care of and some agencies not very well taken care of and the rest of them fall in between. Unfortunately for the Department of Administration, they're on the end of the spectrum where they had almost none of their recommendations funded. The governor was at $27 million. I'm at risk of whining now, but the governor was at $27 million. The House was at $1 million. The governor had funding for a wide variety of projects. The exterior repair of the MnDOT building, which I talked about earlier, agency relocation, asset preservation, demolition of the Ford building on University Avenue, and Capitol Complex parking improvements, and I believe at the end of session last year, the House was only at $1 million for the Department of Administration, and I think that's kind of putting the Department of Administration in a tough spot. But
help us on that parking request. Is part of that, if I recall, Jeepers, Deputy Commissioner Holston just jumped up when I said that. Is he going to come down and talk about parking? It's not DNR parking, is it? Tell us, isn't part of that parking some kind of a green space deal? You got a parking lot over there with grass on it? What's going on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The proposal would add parking in a couple different places, but the main one would be to expand the Centennial Office Building ramp. And the Centennial Office Building ramp is right behind the Centennial Office Building. And when that ramp was built, there was, I'm not clear if it was an actual deed restriction or if it was an implied agreement, but there was a park there where that ramp was built. So when they built the ramp, they built the ramp, and then on the top layer of the ramp, they put a park. So you have green space and grass on the top of the ramp. And what this proposed, and it's kind of steps down as you get from the Judicial Center down towards the interstate, but the proposal here would be one that through user financing would add additional decks to the ramp that would provide for additional parking. And as I said, this would be user financed. The people that park in the ramp would be the ones that would pay for it. The parking issue generally is a difficult one that, I mean, you should think about, because as you know, we're building the new Department of Ag and Department of Health facilities to the east of Centennial Building. The lab building is going in. The Department of Human Services has their new building going in south of the interstate towards the downtown. All these new buildings will be bringing in people, to employees of the Capitol Complex that do not now work in the Capitol Complex. And while the Department of...
Perhaps maybe the legislature was onto something when we... I think when the House suggested, Mr. Representative Junkie isn't here, I have to make the comment, gee, why didn't you move the Department of Ag into, well, I don't know, Rome, Minnesota? I mean, we don't have these, so let me get this straight. Admin sticks these buildings where they don't have parking, and then they're wondering if they don't have parking. I got that straight?
Here we go.
Well, St. Paul might have other places, Representative Mahoney, I'm sure. Right there. Representative Solberg was first.
Well, Mr. Merkins, you're copy, I think, the same quote that the chair did, and that is we should think about parking as you build these buildings. And I think your proposal that, as I understand it, comes from for the additional parking at the Centennial Parking only solves about a third of the parking problem that you have with three new buildings out there. And how do you intend, other than shipping them from downtown St. Paul parking ramps up to the other ones, where are you going to get the parking? Is there a long-term plan for that? Or Alice's district?
I'll answer that.
Representative Hausman will answer it.
What cities all across the country and all across the world know is that you don't just move people to the core city in cars, you move them on buses and trains. So if you will look at the Department of Transportation and the Metropolitan Council, the question you're asking is solved in a different part of this.
You should have built that restaurant on Big Lake then.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to agree with both representatives. It will it will require a variety of solutions to make sure that those folks coming into the Capitol complex have proper parking. And this proposal, to be fair, this proposal will in and of itself not solve the problem. But if you don't fund this proposal, which I would add again as user finance, we're getting that much farther away from having a solution.
Mr. Chair. But it's more than user finance for those that use it as well. Don't you have the entire parking complex and bonds that are sold, and then anybody who parks in it helps pay for the other parking? The reason I say that is when we built the parking ramp that we all park in at the state office building, I think the cost was like $23 that paid off the bonds, and that pays off the bonds, and I think our parking rate now is, what, 42 or something like that, 46. And obviously there's inflation, but if you were to pay user funds for that parking ramp, the $23 would have paid for it or whatever it was. Don't you kind of mix them all together?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, we're coming dangerously close to exhausting my knowledge on how we set up our parking rate structure, but I think you're right. I think there is some mixing of we view parking in the Capitol complex in a totality, and right. And my understanding is the pricing of the ramps, whether you park in a ramp or a surface lot or something else, is adjusted based upon that concept. So I think there is some amalgamation, if you will, and that's as much as I know. And if someone from admin wants to raise to the table, I would.
At some point, you might actually want to think about parking for constituents too. I know that's
public.
I know that's kind of hard, a hard concept, but they might come up here and participate more. But that's
so
hope and a dream.
I think that you've probably already started the discussion about agency relocation costs when you dealt with the deficiency bill, and I already had mentioned that we talked about Department of Ag and Department of Health. Clearly, the Department of Human Services and the other folks that are going to be moving from one place to another are going to be incurring costs, and that is an issue. I'll just sort of tee this up as a tie-in to the biennial budget. The legislature this year is going to have to address how much they want to fund in agency relocation costs and how much they want to fund in the rent differential costs for those agencies once they move in. And members should be aware that it's not just an agency relocation issue. It's both of them are going to have to be addressed financially.
Americans, we do have a few minutes left. Is there someone here from admin? Because now we've talked about that Department of Ag building and health. I did actually have a question.
It would appear not, Mr. Chairman.
All right, then you can answer. But you could maybe find out. If you could ask them, I almost said fellas, which wouldn't have been politically correct, if you would ask those individuals, find out for us if they're buying their furniture from MNCOR, will you? We want to know this thing over in health and ag.
They're
trying to help. I'm a salesman at heart, so trying to work something out with Benson there, get a commission, but I haven't got that cut yet. But check with them, see where their furniture is.
Do you know the phone number for campaign finance?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe that's why I can't get the deal. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I thought there was some provisions in state law that requires the state to purchase. Not anymore. Oh, we can put it back in there in a hurry.
Yeah.
I thought we put it back in after the Supreme Court went out and bought all kinds of fancy furniture from somebody else. But I might be mistaken. Representative Knobloch?
Representative Knobloch, we didn't put it back in. The MNCOR guys tell me that they just want a shot at it. They don't even need preferential treatment. They just like to bid. And so find out what's going on over there. And that's probably why they didn't show up. They knew we were going to ask them.
That Rhodes is sneaky, boy.
I'll send them your way, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Finally, Department of Employment and Economic Development, Governor recommending funding for the redevelopment grant program. We talked about that a moment ago. And the Mayo project, I believe the House had also recommended funding for redevelopment in Mayo. Governor also recommended funding for the Biotechnology and Health Science Zone Grant Program. No funding for that in the House that I am aware of. So that, I think, to my knowledge, sums up the major differences in terms of how the governor lined up with either where the House was at end of session last year or would suggest to be in House File 3. The one final thing in the packet, you'll see a chart of debt service payments over the years. And is that in the packet?
Mm-hmm.
Good. I put that in there just as an FYI. I didn't want to talk about it greatly. But the reason I put that in there is oftentimes when we talk about the state's 3% debt management guideline, I'm concerned that people walk away thinking that 3% of the budget, if we funded up to 3% of the budget for debt service, that would be an equal amount of debt service payments over the years. And the point of this graph is to do nothing other than to demonstrate that and to remind members that while we talk about 3% of non-dedicated revenues going towards debt service, if state revenues go up, then so too does debt service. And that's what this chart shows. So you can see how debt service has been going up as we pass bigger bonding bills. The actual debt service dollar costs have been going up as well. On that, I end my presentation and any additional questions that I didn't cover so far.
Seeing none, and since we're short, we'll have to talk about the zoo and the North Star later. I don't think we get the North Star in 4 minutes. I don't think we'll
just vote yes.
But we'll try some other time. All right, with that, we will adjourn. Thank you. Bill.